Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. This is Philip Lance, your host for today's episode. I'm an analyst in training at the Psychoanalytic Center of California, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Adrienne Harris about a book she edited with Stephen Kuchuk, The Legacy of Sandor Ferenczi, From Ghost to Ancestor, published by Routledge in 2015. Dr. Harris is a faculty member and supervisor at the New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. She is also on the faculty and a training analyst at the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California. She serves on the editorial boards of Psychoanalytic Dialogues, Studies in Gender and Sexuality, Psychoanalytic Perspectives, and the Journal of American Psychoanalytic Association. She is a co-editor of Routledge's Relational Perspectives book series, and I met her last month at the 50th Congress of the International Psychoanalytic Association in Buenos Aires, where she gave one of the keynote addresses. Welcome to the program, Dr. Harris.
Thank you, Philip. I'm really glad to be here and glad to talk, always glad to talk about Sandor Ferenczi.
About Sandor, yeah. So I learned a lot about him reading this book. And usually we begin here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis just asking what led you to putting this book project together?
Well, that's a long story. So if it's okay, I tell a long story.
Take as much time as you would like.
It's so long ago that Lou Aaron and I, who were really initiated a lot of the American work on the modern American work on Sandor Ferenczi, that Lou and I can't remember exactly how we organized a conference on Ferenczi, which took place in May 1991. My bet is that Steve Mitchell was somewhere stirring the pot behind all this. And I had never studied Ferenczi. I'd never read his work. He wasn't taught in any analytic institutes, including he wouldn't have been taught with any great intensity in the William Allison White Institute, which was an analytic institute formed out of the work of Harry Stack Sullivan and people who had been really very influenced by Ferenczi and who had studied with him and been in analysis with him. But he became such a persona non grata. He really was exiled, one might say beheaded, when he lost favor with Freud at the end of the 1920s. So when we did this conference in 1991, it was like discovering a new continent. It was a really staggering experience. And a number of Europeans who'd been really preserved Ferenczi's legacy, Hungarians and French analysts and people living in Switzerland. So a kind of community that had in a very underground way kept his work in their hearts and literally kept his work began to surface in the 1990s. And they came to this conference that was in New York in 1991. And that produced the first book that Lou and I edited called The Legacy of Sandor Ferenczi. But I have to tell you, the experience of sitting in the room and listening to people like André Hénal and Judith Mazaros and Georges Hidache, who has died since then, talk about Ferenczi, it was the model, the metaphor I've always thought is the metaphor of, you know, plate tectonics, where the two continents used to be joined and then somehow they get separated. That's what I felt listening to the story of Ferenczi and his work and his ideas. I thought, I know who I am now. I know who my grandparents were. I know what the lineage is that made me the psychoanalyst that I became. I know a continent used to touch another one and there used to be connections and links. And they came to life again in this 91 conference and then in the book. So Ferenczi was really saved by Hungarian analysts and European analysts. His work was preserved. Michael Bolland, who was really very close to Ferenczi and who went into exile in England around the Second World War, brought the manuscript that we now know as the clinical diary of Sandor Ferenczi. But Michael Ballant was afraid to have it translated in the 50s. He thought it was just too radical a document. So things were saved, but they also were saved in a context of not people not feeling very free to reintroduce his work into psychoanalysis until really the 90s. So this is a story with loss and tragedy and a broken friendship, and a figure who was really powerful and important to Freud and important to psychoanalysis, who just goes off the grid by the early 30s, and it's half a century before he's really rediscovered. So that's a long, a long walk through what happened to Ferenczi and then his recovery, which has been incredibly important for people.
Yeah, but I like how you tell it. It really brings it to life, and some emotional components of tragedy and loss in there. Yes. In this whole story. So 1991 was that first book, and that, strikes me as a long time ago, and around the era when Mitchell published the famous book on that kind of launched, I guess you'd say, relational yes. psychoanalysis. Yeah. There must have been something in the air that the ground had been somehow prepared. There was a readiness in the zeitgeist, I guess, to rediscover Ferenczi.
I think that's a very important sort of like what. Why did that work so well? What was going on? And certainly Steve's own work in really crafting a relational approach, an intersubjective or interpersonal approach to psychoanalytic work, a two-person system, a two-person psychology, which was definitely Ferenczi. And also Ferenczi was very interested in countertransference and the subjectivity of the analyst, and he had a lot of interesting ideas, both clinical and theoretical, about how countertransference was important. Ideas that appear in Winnicott. So that's what I mean by you suddenly learned your history, because learning what Ferenczi was talking about in the 20s and even before, you could suddenly see, well, no wonder Winnicott felt really able to look at the activity of the analyst, the countertransference of the analyst, as a contribution to the clinical work, rather than just a projection from the patient. So a lot of things were brewing, I would say, around being more interested in a two-person system. I think the other thing that's probably important is that really starting after the Vietnam era in the 1980s, there was a much more need to really look at the reality of trauma, both the trauma that could happen in childhood, which Ferenczi had written about in Confusion of Tongues, but also in war trauma. And I think that dimension of what was going on in psychoanalysis was probably pretty important. Another edited book that I did with Steve Botticelli, which is called First Do No Harm, War Making and Resistance. We looked at the work of a French analyst named Françoise Davoine and her husband Jean-Max Godillière. And they write about war trauma, and they write about the pattern where during a war and in the immediate aftermath, everybody's very concerned with trauma, and then it disappears. So I think that in the post-Vietnam era, there was, PTSD was in the DSM. There was a much different attention to what happens to people in combat and when they try to come home. So I think that the question of trauma, both as a childhood phenomena and also as a war phenomena, was probably part of the ground in which Ferenczi's work came to life and grew in a second, second planting in the 90s. Then later, I would say that the clinical diaries are translated into English. They're published. his book on sexuality called Thalassa, that the things begin to appear. There are new translations of the Freud-Ferenczi letters. So a lot starts to percolate internationally and certainly in the U.S.
Okay, so the first book was 1991, and I'm trying to do the math in my head, but the second book is 2015, so that's, I don't know, several decades in there. Why another book on Ferenczi?
I think that the answer to that is that there, in this ensuing several decades, a lot of work went on. People published lots of different articles about Ferenczi. There was an international Sándor Ferenczi network that was formed, you know, within a decade after the 91 book. And there began to be subgroups in America, in Europe, in Italy, in France, in London, a number of people, both constellations of people and individuals who were really undertaking a lot of work and thinking and using Ferenczi's ideas. So it's not sort of radio silence for 20 years, but it's sort of the forms in which people did their work weren't so much in this edited book, but people were writing about Ferenczi. They were using his work. They were extending his ideas about technique. They were extending his ideas about introjection and projection. There was a work of Jay Frankel that's in the second book, but Jay had been really interested in a concept that Ferenczi is the first to develop, and it's in the Confusion of Tongues paper. And in that paper, he talks about what he comes to call identification with the aggressor. And that was really his concept, that one of the things that happens when somebody is kind of caught up in a scene or a relational configuration with a, in a sense, violent and traumatizing person, one interesting strategy is identification. You can be splitting, there can be dissociation, there can be many things, but another thing which he notices is that the traumatized person identifies with the perpetrator. We have a modern term for that, which is to call it the Stockholm syndrome, in which people began to note that often if there were kidnappings or people were somehow put into the control of somebody else and enthralled or kidnapped, often a strange kind of identification took place. And for Ferenczi, this was something that he noticed in patients, in children, in all kinds of situations, as a way to manage sort of unspeakable anguish by becoming the bad one, not just the victim. So that kind of work emerged from reading Ferenczi, but then it had a whole life of its own in journals and in teaching. And so I think a lot went on in the sort of two decades since, more than two decades, since the first book came out. One of the things that happened is that people began to do research on some of Ferenczi's patients. Elizabeth Severn, most significantly, but Clara Thompson, who was a well-known American analyst in New York, has been identified as one of the patients that he writes about in the clinical diary, DN. And RN turns out to have been Elizabeth Severn. So people began to do kind of historical work in the archives, trying to figure out who were these people? You know, what did they do? What did they take? What was it like being Ferenczi's patient? So a lot of research went on, a lot of teaching. I would say Ferenczi was sort of brought into the canon or back into the canon. The Freud Ferenczi correspondence was translated. That's in three volumes. And so I think it wasn't silent, but I think the forms that the scholarship and the work took varied enormously, and people, you know, taught in their local institutes, published in journals, you know, worked with Ferenczi's ideas, but in a lot of different ways. So that's one thing I would say.
So we're kind of talking about how ideas within the field of psychoanalysis kind of unfold and develop and grow. And some of that happens through this natural sort of, I guess, internal processes of people writing and publishing and studying. But you earlier brought in a very interesting kind of factor from the outside, the Vietnam War. I kind of liked how you made that move in terms of how things that are happening in the world sometimes prepare psychoanalysis for new things to happen and change. So maybe that's a good way into you wrote one of the chapters. The book is divided into kind of three sections, context, history, and then my favorite section, the end on theory and what was it? Technique, I guess. Maybe you could just say just a teensy bit about the different sections, but then also, tell us about your chapter on war neuroses.
Okay. So let me tell you how the book was organized. We, in talking about context, we picked three very, important seminal writers on Ferenczi and had them write about their way of working with Ferenczi's ideas and texts. And the first is Judith Mazaros. And Judith Mazaros, who's in Budapest, is absolutely one of the key figures who really saved Ferenczi's materials. She has spearheaded a very successful effort in Budapest to buy an apartment within the house that Ferenczi lived in, which is now a study center devoted to Ferenczi. And she has also written a lot about the Hungarian Psychoanalytic Association and its really very tragic fate during the 20th century. And so, and she's very good at contextualizing Ferenczi both in the context of his institution, in the context of kind of European thought in the late 19th century, the importance of spiritism, the kind of eclectic world that Ferenczi lived in. So her chapter sets a kind of socio-historical context for Ferenczi's development. And then, in a sense, charts the difficulties, partly the difficulties of maintaining Ferenczi. Within a Hungarian perspective, is that the Hungarian Institute was really, between Hitler and Stalin, enormously damaged. About a third of the members of the Institute during the Second World War were lost in concentration camps. Some, maybe a third, maybe managed to be to emigrate either to England or to the U.S., like Michael Bolland, who went to London. And about a third lived through the war, but with a completely broken psychoanalytic structure and institution. So her chapter is really about trying to locate Ferenczi within theoretical and literary and philosophic and social background. Carlo Bonomi has done a wonderful job of scholarship of looking at Freud and Ferenczi in their letters, in their interactions, as they're working out and as Freud is working out things around sexuality, things around mind, projection. So he's very much located within Freud and Ferenczi's time of being very close to each other, which is from about 1910 to about 1925, when they were really seriously involved in doing very collegial things. And Ferenczi was writing papers that Freud loved. The end of his life, he was writing papers that Freud didn't love. But Bonomi really captures the intensity of the Freud-Ferenczi relationship. And then André Haynal, who was another crucial figure, a Hungarian who lives in Switzerland, who really thinks that the most serious problem between Freud and Ferenczi wasn't trauma, but technique. and that Freud, Ferenczi rather, was very experimental about technique, finally doing something he called mutual analysis. And so Heinal is the figure who, in Steve Kuchek and my opinion, really has the whole history of Ferenczi's technical experiments very, very well understood. So that was the sort of the context. And then the history is a lot devoted to people like William Brennan and Kit Fortune and Arnold Rackman and Peter Rudnitsky, who were, and Lou Aaron and Karen Starr, who were really looking at the particular patients that that Ferenczi worked with, and sort of understanding his clinical method and his clinical approach more closely. Then the last section has a bunch of different articles, and it's much more about sort of theory and technique and what are the clinical applications and sort of different topics that Ferenczi was interested in. So that's how we sort of conceptualized the book. And I wrote a paper on paper that Ferenczi wrote in 1917 on war neuroses. And I think a lot because of Ferenczi, but not only Ferenczi, I am very interested in the analysts around the First World War. Because I think, in just the way Vietnam was incredibly transformative for Americans, I think the First World War was absolutely life-changing for any psychoanalyst or psychiatrist who went through it, either as a soldier or as a psychiatrist. So if you think of Wilfred Bion having been in the tanks throughout the war, Ferenczi ran a psychiatric hospital outside of Budapest. There's Simmel, there's Wilhelm Reich, who saw a lot of active service in the Italian front. And there's Victor Tausk, who's a very tragic figure, who kills himself actually in about 1919, and certainly was a traumatized war veteran and psychiatrist also. So I think that that war is very crucial, and that it changed any psychoanalyst that really encountered it. And the exception to that is Freud, who writes very little about that war. It keeps a kind of almost anthropological ethnographer's distance from it. There's one place where he's writing about the treatment of war trauma, shock treatment after the war, in an appendix to a book on psychoanalysis and war neuroses. But for the most part, although he had three boys at the front, I don't think he was transformed by it in the way these other men were. So I wanted to look at Ferenczi's paper on war neurosis and to see how he was looking at, what he was looking at, what he was finding. And it's a very personal paper that he writes, and you kind of feels like he's taken you by the hand and walked you through the hospital and look at this, look at that. And he's looking at men's bodies and seeing that shattered minds often were sort of shattered bodies as well, not just shattered by injury, but shattered psychologically. So I think that there's a lot we know about disturbance and trauma and psychosis that I think we learned in the wake of the First World War. And I think Ferenczi's contribution was a very significant one. So that's what got me kind of interested in writing that particular chapter.
Mm-hmm. And so let's kind of go to the bigger picture of what the importance of Ferenczi is sort of for contemporary psychoanalysis. And I guess the books sort of create an argument for how he's the ancestor of contemporary psychoanalysis. Although it occurred to me, he could be, his impact could be even considered more broadly if we think that, wasn't he Melanie Klein's first analyst?
Yes.
And maybe we could think of the direction she went in as into object relations as being sort of Because of his influence on her. Would that be accurate?
I think it would be. It's always difficult to actually figure these things out, because where Kleinian theory goes is to a view of transference and countertransference that's mostly really organized through thinking about projection, the projection of the patient onto the analyst. And so projective identification, which is one of her most significant developments and concepts, is I think it doesn't include the projective identification of the analyst or the contribution of the analyst, the two person. Mm-hmm. So I think, whereas I think in Winnicott, it really is, there isn't more of an intersubjective dimension to his thinking. So in that sense, you know, Ferenczi certainly would have been influencing a lot of ideas about early development. You know, he was quite interested in child development. He has a really, really amazing paper called The Unwelcome Child and the Death Instinct. And he is it's a paper with a very chilling sentence in which he says at some point, "The unwelcome child dies easily and willingly." And so he was really talking about the degree to which early disturbances in parent-child life could be very traumatic. So I would put him more in the lineage that leads to Bowlby and Winnicott and attachment, and more about the interplay of love and hate, and more about the interplay of the analyst subjectivity as of use to the patient. Whether you tell, it's not really about disclosure, but how does the analyst's understanding of what is being stirred up in him or her, how can it be helpful to the patient? And that question interested him. And I don't think that's a question that engages Kleinians. Klein herself, and it hasn't really been very much a part of post, you know, modern contemporary Kleinians.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually a good segue into another question I had. One of my favorite chapters was the one by Stephen Kuchuk, who wrote on the analyst's desire and erotic countertransference. And he wrote just a really interesting kind of story about his experience as a gay male analyst with heterosexual male patients, and the way that the erotic countertransference there, as he argues, really played a key part in what was productive and useful about the analysis. And, you know, so my takeaway from the chapter kind of was that, oh, every heterosexual male patient should be so lucky to have a gay male analyst, kind of was my humorous takeaway. And I wonder, do you have any thoughts about love in the consulting room and desire and what that has to do with Ferenczi?
Well, I think a great deal. And I think that this topic of erotic countertransference is it was very prominent at the Congress in Buenos Aires. There was a whole panel, Andrea Salenza, Avi Sakutapulu, Julie Levitt from Pink, really talking about the whole question of how do you conceptualize the analyst's erotic attachment to the patient without anybody saying you conceptualize it and therefore it's okay to act on it. Nobody was saying that, but they were certainly, I would say, from a very Ferenczian perspective, they were talking about the inevitability of that kind of intense feeling as mutative in treatments. Sometimes it's a huge problem to handle, but it is also something potentially productive. Harold Searles talks about that as well. And Searles is a very interesting figure because somehow he does not get expelled from the psychoanalytic canon, although he would say in print that he thought that in a certain way, very ill patients didn't really get better until the analyst could sort of imagine loving them or really feel love for them. And he meant erotic love, not just, you know, compassion or empathy. So I think the idea that the analyst's feeling states are mutative for the treatment does come from Ferenczi. It's what made Freud very, very anxious. And it's why when he wrote the Confusion of Tongues paper, Ferenczi, he wanted to talk to Freud about it, and Freud wanted him not to read it at the Congress in 1931 or 32. And he did. And Freud refused to shake hands with him. And when Ferenczi wrote about it afterwards, he said he felt that he was, that Freud was killing him, that he was really not going to survive this. And he doesn't survive very long, actually, after that kind of catastrophe. So this was a scary project, the idea of the analyst's subjectivity, including the erotic attachment. But I think it's part of what we have to talk about.
Then how do we reconcile this idea about the analyst's love, the cure by love, and the real relationship, I guess you'd say, with the analyst, and the more, what I think of in contemporary psychoanalysis, the intersubjective side, which can be sometimes seen as more an impersonal kind of analysis of maybe of how language is being used, semiotics. And there seem like two kind of polar opposite kind of ways of,
you know,
Do you have thoughts about that?
Well, it's interesting. I'm reading a book by Lewis Kirshner now on the origins, or just he's talking about intersubjectivity and semiotics in psychoanalysis. I think it is possible to reinvigorate thinking about semiotics and discourse by sort of thinking about the body and its contribution to discourse, so that language doesn't just become some kind of disembodied thing, but actually is a bodily process. And I think we're having a lot of interesting writing, or reading a lot of interesting things about, rather than just thinking of symbolic or non-symbolic, all these layers of unconscious phenomena, things that are somatic and affective and, you know, not quite symbolized, but nonetheless registered. And I think Ferenczi's focus on the nonverbal, the primitive, the archaic, and the archaic body is part of that that tradition and those influences. And it makes psychoanalysis much harder because, in a sense, you have to notice what you're feeling. You have to notice an erotic attachment. You have to notice your sadism. You have to notice all kinds of things. What you do about it in any given case is highly variable. For some people, they might share it. For others, they might never. But they understand that it's part of the process. You know, there's a very interesting, I don't know that she much talks about Ferenczi, but there's a Israeli analyst, Ashel is her name, who writes about falling asleep in the session and what it came from, sort of in her, in the patient, in the treatment. So, you know, I think once you open this up, it's never going to be just about words. It's always going to include the body, the affect states, the history, and how do you handle it? How do you, you know, when things get difficult, how do you get help from colleagues? How do you, so it's not about, there's no limits to action in any of this new work. There are all the limits to action, but if there's an experience, you have to be able to understand it and wonder, how could it be helpful? How could it be mutated? So I think this is just one of most important topics and one of the most difficult ones for young analysts, old analysts.
Yeah. Difficult, yes. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the book by Kirshner. I forget his first name.
Lewis Kirshner.
Larry?
Lewis.
No. Lewis Kirshner. Yeah, because intersubjectivity in psychoanalysis, because I just read it, and he doesn't know it yet, but I'm going to contact him, see if he wants to talk about that book, because I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, I did too. But it's a really good
book. Somewhat difficult. That's what I picked up on for younger analysts like me. But wow, there's a lot of good stuff in there. But also you mentioned, again, your one of the panels at the IPA Congress. And so I wanted to ask you about the keynote address you gave there, because it probably has something to do with Ferenczi. It was the Congress's theme was intimacy. And your paper, The Tank in the Bedroom, bedroom being a place of intimacy, I think approached the topic differently than a lot of what I heard at the Congress, which I guess was maybe more traditional kind of ways of looking at the question. And the second sentence of the keynote address you gave was, "What I most want to convey today is that sexuality, gendered subjectivity, and intimacy are not simply personal and self-contained, but always invaded by and cohabitating with forces of power and history, whether violent or seductive or dominating." That's a lot for people who aren't familiar with the literature of more of intersubjectivity and contemporary kind of critical ways of looking at things. But it's a beautiful sentence, and I just wondered what you could want to say about that in terms of and any Ferenczian connections there.
Well, I would say that who I have become as a psychoanalyst, where I could write that sentence, would not have been possible without an encounter with Ferenczi, who was not only a psychoanalyst, he was an intellectual, he was a progressive person, he was a left-wing person, he was somebody for whom the social and the intrapsychic were all intermingled. And I think, I also come out of that era of 70s feminism and the Vietnam and the anti-war movement. And so I think in my generation and my kind of coterie of analysts, we assume that the political is personal, and it's also theoretical, and that you always have to be thinking what social power, what regulatory apparatus is being expressed through our institutes, through our ways of teaching, through our ways of working, through our theories. And so for me, intimacy was a chance to talk about something very close in, very private, but to sort of say, but there's the privacy is an illusion. We are always infused by all kinds of historical forces. And I think that, Ferenczi enacted that through the way he used sort of the clinic as a two-person situation. It's not just a person with drives and individuality, but there's always an interaction from the beginning and always. So I think I couldn't have written that kind of paper without some, historic rootedness in Ferenczi's ideas.
And this question's a little more sort of my own sort of little personal question I wanted to ask, but the next Congress in 2 years is in London, and the theme is either femininity or the feminine. And so since this is the first Congress that I'd ever been to, and I thought maybe the next one in 2 years as a candidate, they have a candidates organization that's a part of the Congress called, yes, IPSO. And so candidates write papers and submit them. And so it made me think, I'm talking to Adrian Harris, a perfect person to sort of ask. And aren't you somewhat involved in helping people become writers, helping analysts learn how to write?
Definitely. Yeah.
So maybe you should do a group for some of us about how to write a paper for the next Congress. But what, any thoughts about what we might want to be thinking about in around the topic of the feminine or Ferenczian?
You know, it is the topic is the feminine, which is quite ambiguous. So it's, in a certain way, intimacy was an ambiguous term as well. And people took it in different directions. It may be that they took it in more conventional directions, but one didn't need to. And I think the same might be said for the feminine, which is maybe one of the kinds of projects would be to contest that term. Because in a certain way, I looked at intimacy in relation to, I was tasked with talking about intimacy in relation to gender and sexuality. And I added social violence to that list, and I, in a sense, changed the terms of what I wanted to talk about by thinking of intimacy as always both social and interpsychic. So that would be sort of interesting to think about in the feminine. What would, you know, when you think about that term, how is it useful to you? How is it not mm-hmm. useful to you? What gets in your way? What gets in our way around that term? And, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's, I've actually been thinking that I might like to write something about misogyny. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I don't know quite how it's going to be, you know, it will depend who they get to do the plenaries. That will shape something of the sort of ideology of the Congress. And, you know, the program committee that puts it together, you know, has some role in what they're looking for, what and who they invite to do things. But I think, you know, I think it's a great opportunity, if so, to do something and to also, which should tell you that there is a conference on from the Ferenczi International Sandor Ferenczi Network, which is going to be in Florence. And if you went on a website, Sandor Ferenczi Network or sandorferenczi.org, you would find a website that has a conference that's going to be next May. That's going to be devoted to Ferenczi's work. And, you know, we have actually a panel we're putting together that's going to be just candidates. So we're encouraging people to write. And to, so
okay, yeah, that was helpful. I need to sit down and really think about what femininity needs really means to me, and why it's kind of frightening and provocative, you know. And for all the men who are beginning, you know, going to that conference and having to sort of be forced to sort of give presentations and write about the feminine, that's going to be tricky, maybe somehow, but good for all of us. So let's see, our time's winding down. What are you working on, another projects, or with you, maybe it's plural projects or anything in particular?
Well, I'm actually trying to finish a book of my own essays, in which the plenary, the tank in the bedroom, is going to be one of them. And I've been writing about Winnicott, and Ferenczi will be sort of worked through the many of the different chapters. And I'm also doing a paper on Freud's writing about around the First World War. And in that essay, Ferenczi is definitely a counter voice to the way Freud talks about war trauma. So I keep him close. The other thing I thought about for the Congress on the feminine is not many people write about Ferenczi's book on sexuality, specifically and genitality. And it's called Thalassa. And it's got a lot to do with the feminine, the mother, the regressed. So it's kind of interesting.
Okay, well, we're out of time. But I just wanted to really thank you for taking the time to tell us about this book. Thank you so much.
Thanks very, very much.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Adrienne Harris about her book, The Legacy of Sandor Ferenczi, From Ghost to Ancestor, here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis webcast. Be sure to subscribe to our webcast and feel free to post your comments and questions on the blog site.